Hey, Trojan fans, it's time to get into the huddle with the Peristyle Podcast. The Peristyle Podcast is your weekly ticket to USC football and recruiting news. Don't forget, you can download the podcast 24/7 on our website, peristylepodcast.com. And now, here is the host of the Peristyle Podcast, USCfootball.com publisher, Ryan Abraham.
Hello, Trojan fans, and welcome to episode number 221 of the Peristyle Podcast. Today is May 14th, 2012. We've got a great show for you this week on the podcast. Coach Harvey Hyde is on secret assignment this week somewhere in Las Vegas, but we're going to have Dan Weber on for an extended period of time this week on the podcast, answering all of your questions about the USC Trojans, anything to do with the football team. If you have any questions or comments, we love to hear from you. Email us, podcast@uscfootball.com, or if you want to leave a voicemail, we have a few of those to play for you today. You can call 206-888-6755. Please try to leave a brief voicemail, and we'll play it on the podcast, or go to peristylepodcast.com. Click on the left side of the page, and you can leave a voicemail right from your computer. And like I said, Harvey Hyde on secret assignment. So we got Dan Weber joining us. Dan, what's going on, man? How you doing?
Pretty good. Doing good. Another weekend full of news. Another week coming up. It looks like it's got a lot of news going on. As we've said how many times, if you're involved with USC football, you aren't going to be bored. Stuff keeps happening.
Stuff is happening all of the time. There's always kind of stuff going on here around the program, and we got a bunch of questions to get to on that. Before we do that, I wanted to thank our sponsor, Southern California Tickets. You can go to sctickets.com or give them a call, 1-800-888-7287. If you need tickets for anything, and there's a lot going on in Southern California, as you know, Dan, so much going on. You got the Kings, LA Kings. They went up one game in their series against Phoenix. You got the Lakers. You got the Clippers, both winning exciting seven games. So there's a lot going on there on that front. But Dan, I wanted to get to, definitely give them a call, 1-800-888-7287 if you need tickets for anything. But Dan, I guess some of the biggest news that came out over the weekend, and I wanted to play this voicemail question for you, and we can kind of talk about it.
Yeah, this is Dougie at the top of the grapevine. Been enjoying Trojan football since 1962. I just wanted to know about Paul D. Wanted to know how it will affect the trial with the McNair case and the NCAA. And, my condolences to his family. And I'm just sorry he won't be around to see us hopefully kick some rear this year. And that's about it. And also one more question. I heard a rumor that he did commit suicide. I would like to know if that is true or not. And I just love the show. I listen to it every week. It's the highlight of my week. And the Peristyle Podcast, Trojan Blast, all of it. Just love it. Thank you guys for putting it on. I really appreciate it. Fight on.
Dougie, I wish I could help you on the suicide rumor. I know we actually had, just by accident, friends in Coral Gables who 2 years ago had gone out, and this is not meant as a negative or in a joking way, had gone out to dinner with Paul D. And told us that they didn't think anybody knew about it, but that he had throat cancer and was even at that time really, really sick. And I know he's been battling it, for a good while. I know, we probably were the first ones to report that, that it might have an impact on something like his deposition, which now, was scheduled for next month. And I guess he was, considered in the McNair case as an uncooperative out-of-state witness, and had to be put on the deposition list. There are two schools of thought. I'm not an attorney and haven't done these. There are some who say that it might affect it in a way that we don't foresee, that it might make it, for example, easier for some, say at the NCAA or on the Committee on Infractions, to say, that wasn't us, that was Paul that did that. And he might not be around, he won't be around to defend himself and say it was him. I mean, that's one theory. The other other thing you think might be happening is that at the time he was going to be the only one so far listed on the Committee on Infractions to have a deposition taken from. One would think that would expand now, and that other people on the Committee on Infractions, like Josephine Petito and Missy Convoy and people like that, may be deposed. And so, and I think you can make the case, you know, on both sides of that, that it could give, you know, a more full picture of what's going on or what went on in terms of the USC case. That, you know, we've certainly heard that there were people on the committee saying things like that Paul D and some of the staff at the NCAA took the case in a place where they didn't think they were going to, didn't know about it, and were somewhat surprised when they came out with this really harsh judgment on USC. I think we'll see. It's going to make it even more interesting how this plays out. I know the other theory too is that will this give the NCAA more reason, you know, to want to settle, that maybe they obviously have been delaying and trying to, you know, judge shop and do a lot of things, and now will this tell them that rather than have this, you know, the depositions expand and the email search go through and all of that kind of thing, are they better off just saying, you know, we're sorry, if you can even imagine that they would do such a thing, and saying maybe it got a little out of hand and you know, we'd like to settle and keep everything completely secret from the public. So I wish I could tell you which I think of those is going to happen. I don't think I know, and I'm not sure anybody does right now.
All right, we had one more question on that topic, at least one more voicemail question. Here you go.
Hi, you guys. This is Carl from Kansas City. And I'm calling in response to Dan Weber's interview last week about the Todd McNair trial. I thought it was just such good information, and I think it's something that we would love to hear more about. Certainly I would, to just see what really happened, what the NCAA really did. And I have a couple questions. Number one, what role do you think that USC and Reggie Bush will play should they be subpoenaed to testify in his trial against the NCAA? Will USC just back off if they have with most of what's happened since the whole announcement and the sanctions? Will Reggie Bush play more of a role than he did leading up to the sanctions? And how much coverage do you think the likes of the ESPNs of the world will be covering this trial to let us know really what really happened? So any insight on that information, Dan, would be great. Appreciate you guys and what you do. Fight on, Trojans. Thanks. Bye.
Yeah, interesting question from Kansas City. I promised I'd try to make these short. They're good questions, though. I think the USC one, they've really been removed from this. About as far removed as you could possibly be from this case. Some people are not very happy about that. That's USC's decision. The Reggie Bush question, though, is interesting. Where does he play in to a lawsuit by Todd McNair saying basically, you know, what the NCAA did to him was just completely, you know, a completely made up connection and all of that. No one has thought about, I don't think I've seen that even issue even raised as to the possibility of how Reggie Bush might fit into this case. I don't know. That's a really good question. As to ESPN's coverage, you have to remember that they're a visual medium, and you need, you know, this thing would have to go to trial. There are a lot of people who don't think the NCAA can ever let it go to trial. If it goes to trial in downtown L.A., there will be lots of coverage. If it doesn't go to trial, it's so hard for an ESPN, for example, to cover something that's happening behind the scenes. That just isn't how television works. So I don't know. If I were the NCAA, I don't think I'd want to let it go to trial. That's another good reason why you would think they wouldn't want it to go to trial. But if it does, there'll be cameras at the courthouse, I guarantee you, and people standing in front doing stand-ups every day, I think, because it will have the potential, you know, especially if it happens in, you know, this time frame over the next year or so, that would be dynamite TV. But until that moment, probably not.
All right, then we have one last one. I don't want to beat this to death, but we did get a lot of questions, obviously, when people found out that Paul D passed away over the weekend. Josh, who just graduated from USC and recent 2012 graduate, so I guess he just graduated a couple weeks ago. If the rulings on the Todd McNair case prove that the NCAA was negligent and unfair regarding the punishment handed down to USC, what can USC gain from the result, if any?
Well, I mean, I think it could be like, you know, one of those OJ case decisions where the one that absolutely counted the criminal case, you know, he was acquitted, he lost the civil case, but, you know, that didn't impact him other than in terms of, you know, financially, which would be kind of, you know, I hate to do these as not a lawyer, having not gone to law school or anything else, but it would seem to be the similar kind of thing where it would be a stain on the NCAA and it certainly, you know, nail them financially, but not sure that it's the kind of thing that, that USC could do anything about unless they chose to be really more aggressive than they you know, and try for one more bite at the apple. Now, they've obviously used up the one avenue of appeal, and were turned down summarily. We're not even sure if the people on the appeals committee even bothered to read the, you know, the appeals filing for Todd McNair, for example. It certainly looks like they didn't bother to answer any of it. Pretty much, they just said, "Nope, no, go away. We don't need." Now, would USC find another venue and say, "Look, you know, the NCAA didn't have it in its rules how to deal with a situation like that. But now that this situation's come up, and maybe a first ever of its kind, doesn't the organization owe USC in some fashion or other to make it right?" And somebody might say, "Well, they're making up their rules as they go." Well, duh. You think that isn't what they've been doing the whole USC case? So one more time where the NCAA could make it up as they go probably wouldn't be a bad thing. And if I'm a bureaucrat running the NCAA and I'm found, you know, to have done some of these things to USC that a lot of us suspect that they did, I might want to get ahead of this and say, "Look, that happened before I got here. We're really sorry. We can't imagine that that went on, but it did. Therefore, we have to be right by USC." Can the NCAA do that? You know, can these ultimate bureaucrats handle something that way? I mean, basically, you have to look at, say, what's best for them. They're not basically going to think what's right or what's right for USC or what's right for all of our members. They're basically going to make the decision on what's best for us. If it becomes obvious that the best thing for them to do is to get right with USC, they'll probably do that. But in a way, we don't have any idea how they would do it because there is no mechanism right now for the NCAA to do that.
Yeah, you can't give, like, extra scholarships. Okay, instead,
sanctions
are over. You can have 90.
There's always a way for them to make the decision. I mean, it's hard to even know what group at the NCAA would make that decision. Now, again, that didn't stop them previously from doing things in the USC case just because it hadn't happened before or they hadn't been able to make a decision on something in a particular way before they went ahead and did it. So I don't think that'll stop them, but it's so hard, you know, for people who have gotten to the top of their field, their organization, whatever, by being the ultimate bureaucrat and never having to take the blame for anything. It's not always that easy for those same people to then in any way kind of step up to the plate and say, "Man, we screwed up." That's not what you normally see.
And we haven't certainly haven't seen that recently. So, but well, I know, thanks for answering the questions, Dan. We had a ton of people asking about it, obviously. So we'll keep up to date. We'll keep watching. Keep watching the War Room. I'm sure Dan will have some tidbits in there too.
Yeah, this is just starting. Of course. I mean, here we are. How many years into this? And it's like, oh, another new start. Kind of. It's just amazing.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's move on to some football stuff. This question is from Sean. He says, "Hi, my name is Sean. I had a couple of questions regarding USC football. I'm a Kentuckian, so I thought you'd like this one, Dan,
and
have been a huge fan for life. I was wondering, what kind of role do you see Lamar Dawson playing on defense? Could this be the year he breaks out? And second, I'm in SEC country, so I take all kinds of heat for being a USC fan. But would you agree that it's been quite a while since the SEC has had to play against a Heisman-caliber quarterback who excels at throwing, all in caps, the football? The last time was Bama, Texas, and Gilbert, and Shipley picked them apart after they settled down. Who is to say that if LSU-Bama versus USC title game happens, they won't struggle to cover all of USC's weapons? Defense is great, but USC, I believe, has a great defense this year too, and the last time I checked, 0-0 isn't a win." That's from Sean.
Hey, Sean and Kentucky guys know what they're talking about, I guess. Actually, in growing up also in Kentucky, you were kind of a border state guy. You know, I grew up as basically equal parts Ohio State, Notre Dame, Michigan, you know, that kind of a football guy, and you know, you were the northernmost SEC state, and so you know, spent a lot of Saturday nights in Lexington watching, you know, Ole Miss when they were really good, and LSU always was good. Bama didn't come in all that much, but we were kind of in the middle of two worlds, and you did get to look at how different people approached it. Didn't get to see much of USC till we got out here, and I think you're exactly right. I think the SEC people know their football, and they're smart enough to know they didn't want to play USC in the championship game, and they've been able to, you know, avoid that through all the ways in which the BCS has worked itself out and the way USC – what's happened to USC, and if you notice, there are no more Southeastern Conference opponents on USC's schedule at all, and that's not going to happen. And I think you're right. I think it's much easier. If I'm the SEC and I've got a real athletic defensive team, I think I can get ready to play, say, in Oregon, a team that's essentially going to run the ball with good athletes and good speed. If I've got 4 weeks to get ready for that game, I could really speed up the tempo of practice and do all the things you can. Basically, you're going to be using your good athletes to stop the run. The problem they would have, and the problem, for example, that Oklahoma had in that Orange Bowl after the 2005 season is, no matter how good your athletes are, if they haven't seen anybody that can throw the ball deep and run the ball, and have the kind of skill people at quarterback and wide receivers and have been doing it all year long, there's almost no way, I think, that you can get your team ready to stop the deep ball. There are too many things involved. And as you saw with Oklahoma had all kinds of trouble. They were, you know, they had a couple of All-Americans in their secondary. They kept coming up to try to support the run to stop Lundell and Reggie. And, you know, then Steve Smith and everybody else in the world is running past them, and they didn't have much of a chance. I think even this year, if you look at LSU, we heard how great their secondary was, and two All-Americans, and two, you know, big-time first-round draft picks, and all that kind of thing. And here Alabama, with a really, you know, and I've kidded about this, but I said, you know, Washington State might have three quarterbacks who could start at Alabama. And, they let their kids throw the ball a little bit. And in that game, in the championship game, you saw Alabama's very average wide receivers running past that LSU secondary because they really hadn't seen that this year. So I think a very astute observation. If I'm the SEC, I do not want to play a really good USC team with good athletes on defense and a pretty much sophisticated high-power offense that can throw the ball deep to really good receivers with a, you know, Heisman-caliber quarterback. That would be a nightmare matchup, and that's, of course, why people, I guess, want to look at, you know, first week of January in South Florida and say, what if we, you know, there's a return of Lane Kiffin to the Southeastern Conference and a return of USC to Paul D's homeland and all that before the weekend. People were actually saying, you know, wouldn't it be nice to invite Paul D out to practice someday and see what his handiwork has produced in USC football. But I think good observation.
All right. Well, thank you. I'm glad you like the question from a Kentuckian.
Yep.
Some good stuff. Let's go to Theo. He says, do you think Zach Banner could steal the right tackle spot from Kevin Graf in the fall?
Well, I think it's awfully hard for a first-year offensive lineman, you know, and I would have said that up to the day they inserted Marcus Martin into the starting lineup last year. It's really hard. I think, you know, the thing that next year they're going to benefit from is having an all-veteran. If you, you know, consider Andre Walker, who was certainly in the mix all year long and, you know, in practice all year long and, you know, got first-team reps all year long. I think, you know, the veteranness of next year's offensive line is really going to be, you know, the strong point. You know, you lose a Matt Kalia one year and you lose a Teron Smith, you know, great, great talents. The first offensive lineman picked in two straight, you know, NFL drafts. You're going to make up for that, I think, with smarts and veteran kids really knowing how to adjust and what to do and all of that. And it's almost impossible, I would think, to overcome that as a first-year player, unless, and as it turns out, Marcus was kind of a one-of-a-kind kid who just seemed to, even at the age of 17, just seemed to get it, you know, not all the way. There's no way, you know, a kid is going to get it. Zach Banner, I think, the fact that he's 6'9", the fact that, you know, he really has to work on, I mean, I think he's a terrific athlete. He's got really good feet and a great attitude and great, great potential. But there are some mechanical things and some issues, you know, when you're that big and coming in for the first time. And just the level of competition jumps up so dramatically. You know, it'd be a surprise. But the one thing that won't surprise you is, they will play whoever's the best guy there. And they won't play him because he's a recruit. They won't play him because they've got all this invested in him in terms of their own, you know, egos and bringing him in or anything like that. They'll play him because he deserves to play. That's one of the really good things about this coaching staff is if you deserve to play, you'll play. If you don't, you won't. And it doesn't matter if you're a freshman or a fifth-year senior. I wouldn't think so, but we'll see.
All right. Let's go to David. I know there was some, when we were at the spring game, Dan, they were changing up the PA announcers and trying out some different guys. This I hadn't heard, though. I don't know if this was just rumor or what, and maybe you've heard something. Is any news on whether Pete and Paul will be back on the radio broadcast next season? They talk about Paul McDonald and Pete Arbogast.
Well, I saw, I guess Pete was out at the Ronnie Lott luncheon last week, and I don't get the sense that that's the case. The only thing that we've heard officially is that the plan would be with ESPN Radio signing USC to their first national radio contract for next year, is that they would pick up the USC broadcast for national distribution most of the time. And what we have heard, though, is that there may be an occasion, like the Oregon game or something like that, where ESPN would decide that they would like to use their own announcing team, you know, not to do the USC broadcast in terms of 710, you know, ESPN in LA and the network, but for the national network, that there would be a possibility that they could bring in a national team for that game. But to this point, that's what we've heard, is not a change, but that the potential of a national team on a selected game or so, but mostly picking up the USC broadcast for national distribution.
All right. Thanks for that one, Dan. This question, not so much. We're not I don't know if we'll be able to answer the whole thing, but I wanted to be able to talk about walk-ons and eligibility, things like that, where we're getting a lot of questions, and usually during the recruiting segments on, well, this guy's a walk-on, does he count towards scholarships and things like that? It seems like there's a lot more attention on it just because of the limited scholarships. But the question was, what do you think of the impact Elijah Steen will make? And he was the preferred walk-on that was announced like a month or so ago. And I think some people thought he was offered a scholarship, and that's what people reported at first, but that wasn't the case. He's just a preferred walk-on. Not just a preferred walk-on, but he is a preferred walk-on. Do you think that with training and polish and the DB coach, he could become a surprise impact player? Also, if he plays this year and earns a scholarship next year, would he still have 4 years of eligibility, or does walk-on year impact his years of scholarship eligibility?
Well, I think his eligibility and number of years, it really depends on does he play or not, and not so much his scholarship status. And I do think that would be, you know, that is a way of offering a kid who could be a preferred walk-on with the idea that USC scholarships are going to increase for sure in 2 years, possibly, you know, follow up to our earlier discussion of does the NCAA ever get to a place where it decides to do right by USC in the Paul D penalties, you know, maybe sooner than that. So that may be a way of, you know, of approaching a kid and saying you will be, you know, based on your performance and all that at USC, you'll be in line for one of those, you know, one of those expanded scholarships. But I do think at every position, you know, walk-ons are going to matter. Just finding out that Cody Gifford has decided to, you know, put off graduation and come back for another year. And sort of take Robbie Boyer's place, although Robbie had earned a scholarship. But, you know, Cody will come back and kind of be the veteran, you know, senior, fifth-year guy who will, you know, give a lot of direction. As talented as that receiving core is, they need bodies to do reps in practice. And that'll, he'll matter. And I think at virtually every position, they're going to have a walk-on or two that will really help, if nothing else, really matter in practice. And with the you know, the theme of prep, it's all about the prep. Those guys really are, you know, are important. So I mean, I think you can look at any of the, you know, walk-ons, any of the preferred walk-ons, and say, you know, those guys are going to matter. And USC has proved, I think, over the years that if you get the job done, you know, guys like Abe Markowitz and people like that who've earned, you know, Tony Burnett, who have shown on the field that they can contribute, you know, they've earned a scholarship and you know, they keep a place, a really important place in, you know, in the U.S. on the USC depth chart and on the practice field. So, you know, I think, yes, he will matter, and yes, he'll have a shot at a scholarship when those become available.
All right. Thanks for that one, Dan. Let's go to, this is a question on the old gray lady talking about the Coliseum. Here you go.
Hey, Ryan, Coach, everybody there at the podcast. This is your buddy Greg, high atop Signal Hill. Hey, just had a update question about anything that's going on in the Coliseum regarding getting the seats replaced, new video boards. Any update on that? Hey, thanks a bunch. And as always, fight on, brothers and sisters. Beat everybody.
Well, beating everybody might include the all the politicians that are involved in the Coliseum Commission, which was one of those really, really bad ideas. Say, you know, hey, let's get people from the state and the city and the county, and let's put them all on a big board, and let's see if we can run the Coliseum that way. And it's absolutely been a disaster. You know, they lost money, people are going to jail. Nobody was on top of anything. I will say this: USC did get a good deal on that video board. You know, after you know, pushing them to the limits on the fact that you've got to start living up to your contract, and you know, or else we'll be glad to, you know, take it over and make it part of the campus, and we'll take care of it the way we take care of the rest of the campus. And the politicians said, "Oh no, we can't do that. Why?" what about our free parking spaces and tickets? You know, oh my gosh, and you know, I won't get my name in the paper. So here USC, you know, and now we have a delay again where they're saying, you know, where there was pretty much of a one-sided kind of a coverage of the story that, you know, the state's not sure they want to, you know, Governor Brown, not sure he wants to give it up to the USC because it might be worth more than USC would end up having to pay for it. If USC puts in the $70 million of improvements that are coming up, you know, due here, and if USC only pays $1 million, you know, rent for the next 99 years, that, oh, isn't the Coliseum worth more than that? Let me say this. If USC doesn't play its football games there, the Coliseum, you know, as somebody said, what's a number lower than zero? I mean, it's worth nothing. And, you know, when are those people going to step up and say, you know what, we couldn't manage it. We couldn't develop it. We couldn't do anything other than basically not live up to our contract to USC. And it's time for us to turn this over to the people who care about it, to the people who've been there from the very beginning and are there now for the Coliseum. And the only hope of the Coliseum is for USC to take it over. And for these people to still be standing in the way is just the height of, you know, all of the things that are wrong with politics. I mean, there's no reason for any of those people to be doing anything other than saying, thank you, USC. This will preserve, you know, in a lot of ways, the most important stadium in the history of the world. I mean, you know, when you look at its history, and it really needs work. And USC, if you look at the rest of the campus, and then you look at the Coliseum and you think USC is going to let this go downhill? You think USC is going to, you know, do anything other than preserve, you know, this really significantly important historical building? No, of course not. Now, you know, will USC have more control? Yes. Will the politicians have less say? Yeah. That's a good thing. You know, from my standpoint, that's a really good thing. But if you're a politician, and this is one of your little things you got going for you, that's not a really good thing. So we'll see. You would think USC could back them down eventually, but it hasn't been easy over the years. These people don't want to give it up.
We don't like to see politics get involved in football, but it happens sometimes. Let's see. Let's move on. Theo had another question. Devon Kennard seems to be developing into a fantastic end, but I haven't heard anything about Horton. On the other side, he's talking about Wes Horton. How is he developing? I think Kevin Green should replace him. What do you think?
Oh, no. Wes Horton probably had as good a spring as anybody and has had. Wes Horton is probably kind of the quietly developing big-time story. I mean, he's becoming he's so smart, so active. He's got really good hands. He can play inside if he has to. He just goes about it kind of like a Lawrence Jackson, kind of quietly. Nick Perry, you know, got so much of the attention last year. I think in probably the last couple of years, I think Wes has been an unappreciated asset. I love Kevin Green. You know, his personal story, his hard work, his, you know, development, his strength, all of those things. He hasn't played a lot of football in his lifetime. And, you know, keeps working and working and working, and you really, you know, can do nothing but root for the kid. You know, got his diploma, you know, going to be back, and just a great influence on the team. But Wes Horton absolutely is going to be, you know, a standout this year. Talked to Coach, you know, Orgeron, and he raves about him, and I think you may have missed the one piece on Wes from the spring, but they really look at him. I mean, Devon's got all the fabulous athletic skills and a great kid and personality. I mean, it's amazing how many really sweethearts they've got on defense, because you always think of the defense, the kids are the really tough guys and all that. But they really have a lot of great kids. But Wes Horton is the guy who probably has develop the most, actually, and the one that they're really looking to to anchor the defensive front. So no, I don't see Wes in any way being moved out of there.
All right, let's go to we have one last voicemail question, Dan. We'll play that one for you now.
This is Kelvin Amici out of Van Nuys, California. I just had a couple questions in regards to Jesse Scroggins. At the spring game, his hips seemed fine. They didn't seem to bother him. He looked pretty mobile out there. So I wanted to know, is him transferring a real possibility between now and by the time the season starts? Or do you see him staying at USC and working out his academic issues and competing for that number two spot behind Matt Barkley? Once again, this is Kelvin Amici. Right on.
Well, that's a good point in terms of, I think, you know, today's one of the days we got to really find out. As Lane said, and I really, you know, believe this, as he said at the end of the spring, there's no sense in thinking about where he is on the depth chart or where he could be until we see where exactly he is academically. And, you know, reading between the lines, as Lane talked about it, and as we heard from, you know, some people close to, you know, Jesse, I mean, for a time there, it looked like he wasn't going to be back for the second semester. And there was, you know, kind of a rethinking of where he was academically that seemed to allow him to be back. And, you know, with a resolve that, you know, he was going to square away all his academic stuff, which put him further back as well as an injury, he had a hip injury from stepping a bad step he took on the field, and that first we thought he hurt his foot, and then it turned out he kind of twisted his hip. So he had a double whammy this spring, so didn't get much done at all this spring, but academically, as Lane said, he was behind. He dug himself a really big hole academically. And so, you know, we should know with summer school coming up by the end of the week and that where he stands academically before we discuss, I think, the next step as to where he is, you know, football-wise. But, you know, with Kessler and Wittek getting all the reps they got in spring, you know, if he was in a big hole academically, kind of in a big hole, you know, football-wise as well. So you wouldn't think that, you know, he's in the best position to move into that second spot. But I guess we'll see. And a transfer, I think, is always a possibility. And I'm not going to say that that's on the horizon or whatever, but there are times, you know, it probably makes sense for everybody involved. Not saying that's the case here, but I don't know that it would be something to be feared. I think it might be the kind of thing where USC, you know, anybody that has Jesse's best interest at heart might say, you know, when you weigh everything, maybe it's the best thing. I don't know that Jesse really wants to transfer. I think he really likes USC, and I think he's very happy at USC in a lot of ways. So, you know. It's not an easy question to answer.
All right, we got a couple more to get to. Let's go to John. He said, I recently watched the Oregon game again. When Kiffin became more aggressive and pushed the ball downfield a little more, the offense looked really good, rather than all of the screens that they started the game out with. Did they move to more of that in spring ball or get back to the 101 ways to run a wide receiver screen? That's from John.
Well, you know, I mean, I think if you were saying that after the first half of the season, you know, I think you're right that there may have been a, you know, overemphasis on the kind of throwing the ball out wide, you know, a few yards and trying to get, you know, trying to be safe and what have you. But you know, once you watch the rest of the season, you know, if you watched, you know, pretty many, you know, Stanford and Notre Dame and Colorado and UCLA and what have you. I mean, and they're running down the field and throwing the ball, you know, vertically and very much vertically and very much, I think, working on that game. And I think without a doubt, you're going to see a lot of that next year. I mean, first of all, They've got two wide receivers, you know, that you could make the case of the best in the country. Both of them very athletic. Both of them, you know, can run like crazy. And so the more they run and the deeper they go, the more they open the field up. And then basically you've got a lot of underneath stuff. You've got a lot of, you know, area for the tight ends to work. You've got an area for, you know, a guy like a, you know, George Farmer or, you know, or Devon Flournoy to, you know, come underneath. You've got more room for Curtis McNeil if you can pop him or DJ Morgan. So I don't think you're going to have to worry about going back to the Syracuse game or the Minnesota game at all. I think that's like that's kind of ancient history, I think, with the program. I think some of that was not being certain that the of the offensive line and you know what kind of protection are they going to give Matt Barkley, and not being you know sure of say are we going to get a fullback to be able to block and then they solved that problem with Red Ellison and Ross Cumming and guys that you know were veterans and dependable and blockers and they felt like you know we can throw the ball as deep as we want and we can give Matt as much time as we want. So I think it was a combination of things and maybe an overemphasis on what could go wrong here. And I think just as coaches develop and as teams develop, they just became naturally more aggressive and naturally, you know, started to see all the things they could do when they, you know, threw the ball deep and ran those guys down the field and had them split as wide as they could. And just opened up the football field. I mean, that field, some of those games, there was so much room, you know, you just thought whatever they run on this play, they're going to be fine. I mean, you know, they couldn't double up both Robert and Marquise. And so I would not worry about, you know, 101 ways to throw a screen.
I think USC was up 28-7 in that Oregon game, so it seemed to start off pretty good anyway, Dan.
Yeah, they were pretty aggressive. They were aggressive. They were not afraid at all. I mean, I think that was the change. And just like at the Notre Dame game, the Oregon game and what have you, they were aggressive from the get-go, and they were making life tough on those defenses. I mean, those defenses were really overmatched and knew it. You know, again, you got Robert Woods and Marquise Lee and the way the tight ends developed and Matt, you know, just getting this, you know, so comfortable with what he was doing, it made sense. So, yes, you're right. They took it to Oregon pretty good. I think that shocked Oregon as much as the fact that USC was able to run with Oregon's speed on defense. But the fact that USC just took it to them offensively with the aggressiveness that they did. So I think that was one of the secrets of the second half of the season is that USC decided we're going to be aggressive, we're going to take the game over, and we're going to dictate how this game is played.
Here's an interesting one, Dan. What do you think about switching Farmer, George Farmer, from receiver to corner? He's thick-bodied, faster than most receivers, and when healthy, he has a knack for finding the ball. He wants to be a receiver because it allows him to make plays. What could be better than taking a play away from another team and returning it for points? Plus, he can cover DeAnthony Thomas. What do you think about that? Okay.
See, I don't see George's skill set that way. I think when you look at corners, you really see guys with you know extremely quick feet. And George has fast feet. He has powerful feet. He doesn't have quick feet exactly. And so you're asking a guy, you know, I think, you know, George is a, you know, a power sprinter. And there are some, you know, tremendous advantages to being a power sprinter. But I'm not sure playing defense is one of those things. I think it's much easier for a guy like that to be an offensive player when you know what the pattern you're going to run and you know where you're going. And watching him in the spring before he pulled that hamstring, it was a lot of progress in terms of his route running and planting his feet and doing all that. But he doesn't have the kind of – now, like if you said Robert Woods could do that, I'd say absolutely. You know, Robert Woods with his feet and his ability to, you know, to change directions and stop and start on a dime and all that, I would say without a doubt. But as far as George as a cornerback, I don't see that matchup at all. Size-wise, you know, he's going to be around 210 pounds, and that's probably minimum. So I don't see that as a fit. Safety, I think offense is where George probably should stay.
Makes sense. And no one, let me assure everyone out there, no one watches feet that covers the USA Trojans more than Dan Weber. So he's always checking out feet, shoes. He knows what's going on when he's talking about feet.
Well, this is a carryover from being a high school coach. And honest to gosh, when you were looking at kids as freshmen coming in and all sports, actually, you really got a sense of where they were going to be and how they were going to develop by watching their feet. And how did they, you know, how did they move through space? And how long did their feet stay on the ground? And all of the kinds of things. And there are just, you know, there's enough difference between, you know, whether you're playing offense and defense or what position you're playing that feet really matter, you know. And I always go back to, and I almost apologize, I guess, for the, you know, the late great coach John Wooden, whose first lecture to his players every year was how to put their shoes and socks on and how to tie those shoelaces and his old Converse Chuck Taylor eye tops. But I think Coach Wooden was onto something. I think he kind of knew what he was doing, and I think you can really learn a lot by watching guys' feet.
All right. I wanted to talk to Andrew out there. Andrew sent a question a couple weeks ago about a bunch of different USC players. Where are they now? We're still working on that. We'll try to get you the complete list of everyone you asked about. But we did catch up with a couple guys. I met with Brad Otten at the Settebello Pizzeria in Pasadena. He's opened three of them, one in Vegas and Salt Lake City, and they're opening another one as well. And they opened the one in Pasadena fairly recently. So I was up there with Coach Harvey Hyde on Thursday. We'll have a story coming up on USCFootball.com a little later today. You can kind of see what was up to him. Some people don't remember, Dan. He threw for 391 yards in that Rose Bowl against Northwestern.
Well, actually, that was the first Rose Bowl I ever covered. I was covering Northwestern. I remember it vividly because I was sitting in the last row of the press box, and the guy sitting on a stool directly behind me was the great actor from Northwestern, played Moses, Charlton Heston.
Charlton Heston, yeah.
And he was sitting on and he'd like tap you on the shoulder and ask you what happened and whatever. But I do remember being surprised. I mean, obviously we all knew about Keyshawn. I was surprised how good Brad Otten was in that Rose Bowl. He was very impressive, and a game they didn't let Northwestern really get in that game. But yes, I absolutely I remember.
Yeah, and he normally split time with Kyle Wacholtz, and he started off so hot, they just let him, John Robinson let him play the whole game. So we got a good story on him. We'll try to get some more of these Where Are They Now things. Jacob Rogers, the former USC offensive tackle, won a national championship under Pete Carroll, played under Paul Hackett as well. We got a story coming up with him. He owns a gun shop and shooting range up in Ventura, so I went up there over the weekend and met with him. So we'll try to get you guys some updates on USCFootball.com during the offseason on some of these Trojan players and where they've gone on after football, what their lives have been. So it's pretty fun. It's fun to catch up with some of these guys.
Yeah, that'd be great. I'm looking forward to that. That's great. I loved Jacob Rogers had a lot to do with setting the tone for where USC football was going under Pete Carroll. He was a big part of that. Those first really good teams. That'll be great to catch up with him.
All right, and then one last thing before we let you go, we're going to do a little unofficial, just kind of questionnaire for everyone that listens to the podcast. We get a lot of feedback, and I want to get some more feedback just on what you like, if we can tweak things and make it a little better for you. So we'll five random questionnaires I'll pick out that get emailed to me at podcast@uscfootball.com. We'll send you a free R75 are better than your 85 t-shirts. Just follow this format. I want you to put numbers 1, 2, 3, and 4 and answer the four questions. 1, length of the podcast, if you think it should be longer, shorter, whatever. Number 2, what's your favorite part of the podcast? Go ahead and say Dan Weber if you want. Number 3, what's your least favorite part of the podcast? You can say me, whatever you want to say. And then 4, any other questions or comments you have. So just kind of label it 1, 2, 3, 4, email it to podcast@uscfootball.com. And we'll pick 5 at random and send you a free R75 are better than your 85 t-shirt, which are very popular, and people are really loving them, especially as the season comes up. We got some hats coming too, Dan. So the 75 greater than 85 hats and stuff. So especially as the season comes, I think people are going to really be wanting to get these things.
Well, I'll put in my favorite part of the podcast. I think we get a heck of a lot of smart questions. And I've told people I think USC football fans are that's as smart a fan base as there is in the country. And I think it proves it most every week with the questions we're getting on the podcast. So that's my favorite part.
All right, Dan. Well, thanks. And my favorite part is you answering those questions. I really like it. Great stuff. We didn't even prep him, folks. We just I throw questions at him the whole time, and he has stuff on the tip of his tongue. So it's good stuff. But thanks again, Dan, for coming on the show. We appreciate it.
Enjoyed it very much, Ryan. Thanks a lot.
All right. And everyone else, thank you very much for tuning into the Peristyle Podcast. We will have a Trojan Blast podcast coming up tomorrow on Tuesday. So we'll have Gerard Martinez on there. You can send in your questionnaires about the podcast 1, 2, 3, and 4. We appreciate that. We appreciate you listening to the Peristyle Podcast. Thanks again, and we'll talk to you all next week.
You've been listening to the Peristyle Podcast, presented by USCFootball.com. Be sure to tune in next week for the latest news on Trojan football and recruiting. And don't forget, you can automatically download the podcast directly to your iPod or MP3 player for free. Just click the iTunes link on peristylepodcast.com or search for Peristyle Podcast at the iTunes Music Store.